And hello and good morning and welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the UC Irvine campus. We stream live at kuci.org and we podcast, although we're having a little bit of trouble with iTunes right now, but it will be back. You can find the archive at writersonwriting.blogspot.com. Today's Wednesday, February 12th. 2020. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guests today are novelists Jenny Ophiel and Ita Fromm. First up is Jenny Ophiel. She's the author of the novels Last Things, which was a New York Times Notable Book of the Year and a finalist for the LA Times First Fiction Award, and Department of Speculation, which was shortlisted for the Folio Prize, the Penn Faulkner Award, and the International Dublin Literary Award. She lives in upstate New York and teaches at Syracuse University and in the low residency MFA program at Queen's University. And she's here today to primarily talk about Weather, published by Knopf. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Oh, of course. Well, let's begin with you introducing Weather and talking about how the book came about.
Well, the book sort of came out of a series of conversations I had really over a decade with one of my best friends, the novelist Lydia Millett, who is also an environmentalist. And over the years, as I learned things about her about extinction and about what was going on with climate change, I kept sort of asking myself the same question, which was, why can I think about these things and sort of abstractly recognize them as a problem, but I don't really feel anything about them? And that led me to wanting to create a character that could move over the course of a novel from thinking about these things to feeling them in a more visceral way. And that's how I came up with the character of the librarian at the center of the novel.
And I read a New York Times article in which the writer talked about how you became interested in historical accounts of scurvy.
Yes. The part that was left out of that article is that I ended up making a short film with a friend of mine who's an experimental filmmaker, and it was partly because I'd read this fantastic academic book about scurvy, and one of the things that I was just taken with in the story was the kind of longing that these sailors, often people who had to kind of overwinter in terrible conditions, what they felt for the flora and fauna and the foods of their remembered lands. And somehow, when I read all those articles, we've all read those articles about how this is going to disappear, that is going to disappear because of climate change. And the two things in my mind just sort of felt like interesting juxtapositions.
Yeah, that is interesting. Is the film anywhere that we can see?
It's not done yet. But it was lots of fun to make. I ended up being, because it's a very, very low budget film, I ended up also being the prop master of the movie, which is how I learned that apparently the aesthetic of my house is like early 19th century polar explorer, because I was able to pull a lot of rusty and sort of loosely tied together in scruffy clothing in a gif.
That's funny. I think I also read in that same article that you have a sock line or something where everybody matches up socks when they're found.
Right. We have it's named the Sock Refuge, and it's the same problem, of course, that anyone in any household has. But my daughter often has these very cool, stylish socks that are quite noticeable if you lose the other one of them, you know. And so we put a little area for them to be, and now if you match them up, I think if you get 5 matches, you get $1. So that's become a way to motivate the family to not give up on the song.
That's great. Well, you know, sort of in talking with you and sort of feeling, I don't know, your humor, to talk about the book Weather, one might think it's sort of downbeat and depressing and doom and gloom, but it has such a sort of light tone. It's kind of funny, it's sweet, it's flip, it's also a how-to in a way for how to survive. Talk about capturing that voice. Or is that just you in whatever you write?
Well, I do feel like my own preference is for books that are very dark but also very funny, and they don't always go together. I mean, I've certainly read my share of very somber, serious books that felt like worthy things to read, but at the end, I felt like I had to just lie face down on my bed for a few hours, not quite make it out into the sunshine. So I guess for me, humor is, I wanted this character and also the character in my last book, Department, I wanted it to be a good coping mechanism for them. And I also think that sometimes when we're going through difficult times, you do see the world a little more sharply, a little more clearly. And anything funny that happens is almost a gift that's been given to you, the absurdity of what you're dealing with compared to the sort of harsh facts of your life. So I thought that this novel would be very hard to read if it were just concerned with gloom and doom, because the truth is we all live our lives existing at sort of different ranges of this. You may have a big overreaching concern like what's going to happen to our climate, but at the same time, you need to get your kids to school and you need to return that phone call and you need to buy aluminum foil at the store. And so I wanted to sort of have all those things exist together because I think that's actually how we're living right now.
That's so true. So true. And everybody, all the characters are dealing with some form of anxiety, just sort of as everybody now in the world is dealing with some form of anxiety. Ben's worried about religion, spirituality. Henry's worried about the baby. Lizzie's worried about everything else, and especially her kids. Did you, I mean, they almost are archetypes, and I don't know if you thought of them that way or if they just sort of evolved that way.
Well, I don't think I specifically thought of them that way. I mean, I have noticed, I teach, and I've noticed in particular with my undergraduates and graduate students over the last few years, a sort of just uptick in what feels like generalized anxiety. And I've just been sort of noticing it, I think, certainly with the last presidential election. It felt like the sort of level of ambient dread became pretty high with most people I know. So I wanted to somehow capture that as the atmosphere, but then each person's sort of particular worries that they had also kind of, if you think of it like a cup, you know, your cup of worries, and then we already have it half full with the political situation and concern about the climate change, and then your own just sort of start to fill it up and tip it over. So that's what I was thinking about with each of them. I mean, the only person in the story that, you know, in my mind has an actual anxiety disorder is Henry, is the brother. I mean, mm-hmm. His thoughts, his worries about how he's afraid he might hurt his baby, you know, sort of veer towards a more clinical diagnosis of a particular kind of, like, intrusive thought or OCD anxiety. But the rest of them are just sort of swirling in that swirl we all feel these days.
Yeah, the love between Henry and the narrator is so tender. She cares about him so much. And I was so curious about where Henry came from.
Well, I'm an only child, so mm-hmm. Henry was it was a really fun, really interesting challenge for me to try to capture a brother-sister relationship. I mean, one of the things I knew, I have had brother-like people in my life, and I've had experiences in sort of my extended family which had to do with kinds of caregiving of that sort. But I think one of the things that I had noticed and admired in some of my friends with their brothers or sisters is a kind of way that they coped with bad times through sort of teasing, needling humor of each other. And so I wanted to capture some of that, where also she, at the same time of, you know, at one point he worries that when he was a child, he somehow sold his soul to the devil. They were raised quite religious, and she says, yes, but, you know, what did you get for it, Henry? Mm-hmm. Think about it. And there's a lot of moments like that where she sort of teases him, and he comes out a little bit of the dark place he's gone. So for me, and also it was just a way to talk about the question of care. You know, in my last novel, it was very much about motherhood and marriage. And in this one, I wanted to extend the circle of care, sort of both to the people that come in the library, to her immediate family, and then also to, as the book goes on, sort of to the idea of, like, strangers and neighbors.
Hmm. Yeah, I love that she's a librarian. At one point in the book, a character says to her, "How do you know all this?" And she's like, "I'm a librarian." that was great.
Well, I love libraries, and I think it's a little bit of a, you know, most of us have some other life that we would have happily had, and I think I would have quite happily been a librarian. I also feel like they're just little moments for me of where you can envision kind of what it would look like to have a real commons that people could go to, because, you know, we don't have to pay money to go to a library. Mm-hmm. Everyone's welcome. Librarians tend to know all sorts of things. If you sit in a library in a given day, you're going to watch a librarian help people find books, but also put together a job resume in some urban areas where there's a drug problem. They may administer Narcan. I mean, there's just a huge range. They're sort of the first responders these days. And I think it's pretty heroic.
Yeah. And the library is also kind of symbolic for what's happening in the world. Things have gotten rough at Lizzie's library. Now there are glass cases that encase flyers. Mm-hmm. And I found that those glass cases so symbolic for just the world and what's going on. Talk about that.
Yeah, well, the glass cases are prior to, I guess, in the lead up to the election, the way that they had it in the library was you could just post things on the board with poster board. But then someone, they don't know who it is, starts putting up these kind of hate-filled, xenophobic screeds. And so then it becomes something where you have to ask for the key. The librarian has to go over with you, open it, and then you can put your flyer up. And it's kind of an example of, like, how public discourse is falling apart, and how these more sort of extreme moments of speech and of hate are flaring up, even in the library.
Everywhere. It's
everywhere. Yes.
Department of Speculation was written with a similar structure to Weather, and I'm so curious how your structure happened. Talk about that. It was, you know, I remember reading Department of Speculation and loving it, and found it inspiring in that, you know, here's a novel that doesn't follow the traditional sort of structure, right? I mean, it's the snippets and everything. It does have a dramatic arc, just not in the same way as we're used to.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think with Department, and I've followed it in a lot of ways with Weather as well. What I kind of discovered that I wanted to do was I like to write. I'm not one of those writers that makes an outline for a novel and then writes it straight through in many drafts, and the first draft is terrible and the last draft is the one you turn in. Instead, I kind of write in these small little pieces, and I make them the way I want them to be, and then I collect them. And I'm not sure for some period of time exactly how they go together. That's the part that really has to do with intuition. Sometimes I even cut them up into little pieces and put them on board so that I can see it outside of my head. But what that does ultimately for me is it allows me to make connections between things that I might not have normally done if I was working from an outline. And it also, to my mind, allows for kind of an organic process of, I take quite a while to write my novels, so one of the things about having these smaller pieces is that I go over and over and over them, and, you know, time just edits most of it out. I mean, because something has to stay and still seem interesting to me or radiant to me in the process, and then at a certain point, the story becomes apparent to me. And at that point, I begin to assemble them, notice what's missing, notice where I want to go, but it's a little bit late in the process for most novelists when I do that. And then with weather, it has the same idea, but I wanted it, we always talk about sort of atmospheric novels, but I wanted it to sort of literally be that a little bit. I wanted it to move in these kind of eddies and flurries almost, and so it doesn't have chapters all the way through the way Department did. It has sections, and it has a lot of white space, as Department did too, which are meant to be kind of landing places for the reader, so that that it doesn't just feel like a rush of assorted ideas, but it feels like there's moments where you almost collaborate with me as the writer, and you bring in your own associations and your own moment to kind of tie things together.
It's really interesting. You know, in that New York Times article, once again, there is a photograph of your poster board with manuscript fragments. And so when you look at that, and everybody should find that New York Times article. I love that photograph. But when you look at that, like, what are you seeing? Or is everything up there in the order you think it might go? Or are you kind of switching things around?
No, I usually do them by, I usually do them sort of thematically. So, like, one might be mystical or transcendent sayings or moments. One might be all scenes that are the brother and sister. One might be kind of moments that are going to be a bit funnier that I'll want to use to kind of cut through the more serious scenes. So it's in some ways it's like a rhythm. Like I have to figure out, okay, it's gone for a while in this direction. What does it need now? Because I sometimes I feel like there's too much of this and there's not enough of that. And then I can go and look at the boards and see things again. Especially, and sometimes it'll be facts. Like if I have a lot of facts about one particular thing in a book, you know, I had a whole board that was all about ecology and climate change. So I would go and look at that. And that's just, it's just something about having it outside my actual head. A lot of visual artists do this. You know, they do kind of chance operations, or they do things that are meant to kind of jostle them out of their usual ideas. Mm-hmm. So that's how it functions for me. I tend to do it when I'm stuck, like midway through a book, when I keep having things go together in a certain way, but I'm just not feeling like that extra thing has come in yet. You know, the part that you can't exactly force. You just have to have the intuition that, oh, it needed this, or, oh, it needs that.
Well, you have multiple boards for one book?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I probably had about eight or nine.
I see. One. So one of them was the climate ecology one, you know, different.
Yep.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
Got it.
Yeah, but I don't put them up in any order. Like, in other words, I sort them into piles, the little scraps, and then I paste them up without regard to, you know, where they would be in the book or anything. That's the part that's kind of the chance operation part, because things just get put next to each other. In fact, I do it almost like a puzzle, like, oh, I need a short thing here because I'm trying to fill that space. And what that does is sometimes it makes something appear that I haven't been noticing, or it makes something that I've just been reading over because I've been assuming it had to be where it was. It makes me realize, oh, maybe I don't need it.
Yeah, that's so interesting. So interesting. You have been listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Jenny O'Fill. Her book is Weather, published by Knopf. We have a few more minutes. And I wanted to mention your endnote, the obligatory note of hope.com.
Well, when I was in the process of writing this novel, you know, you go through an extremely grandiose part of writing a novel where I think I'm going to put everything in and finally I'm going to write a, you know, super long novel. And then slowly as the book goes on, I realize, no, that's not actually what this should do. But I did come across a lot of things that actually did make me feel hopeful about the climate emergency. And a lot of them were people that were doing interesting things in their community, also people in different moments in history that had kind of gone against the grain and stood up to powers that be that were frightening. So what I did was I just made a little website. The first part of it is called Tips for Trying Times, and that is maybe about 50 little examples of what people did. What did people do to pass the days during the siege of Leningrad? What happened in Sarajevo when people couldn't didn't have milk to bake? All these kind of things that I came across, which when you read, if you read weather, there's also lots of sort of little prepper bits, but these were more emotional prepping, like how do we keep our spirits in the worst of times? And then at the very end, there's a portal that you can go into three organizations that are doing collective action, because I think one of the things I really came to by the end of this novel is how important it was to do things with other people, to not keep trying to imagine yourself as an individual who needs to consider these things, but rather as part of a community.
I love that. Yeah. I had to go to the website, of course, and go through the various links. It was great. It was great. We are at the end of our time. I wonder if you might mention a couple of novels that you love that are dark and also funny.
Okay, sure. I think there's a book by Donald Antrim called The Hundred Brothers, which definitely fits that bill. I just read, is it funny? I'm always like, is it funny? my friend who I was first speaking of, Lydia Millett, mm-hmm. she has a real way of, even in the seemingly darkest books, there'll just be a laugh out loud scene. So I turn often for inspiration to her books like Magnificence or How the Dead Dream. Mm. There's one really funny book by Mary Robeson called Why Did I Ever, which I like to recommend.
Mm. Jenny, thank you so much for coming on
thank
the show
you.
And continued great luck with weather. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. That was Jenny O'Fill. Her book is Weather, published by Knopf. Lily King is the award-winning author of the novels The Pleasing Hour, The English Teacher, Father of the Rain, and Euphoria, one of the New York Times Book Review's 10 Best Books of 2014, finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award and winner of the Kirkus Prize. And she's here today to talk about writers and lovers, and can't wait to talk about this. I've been wanting to talk to you ever since I read Euphoria, actually.
And, great.
I'm so happy to see you have a new book. Let's begin with you telling a bit about how the book came about.
Okay. Thank you so much for having me.
Of course.
I really didn't mean to write this particular book. After Euphoria, I really thought that I would continue to write things that involved a lot of research and took me to faraway places and a different time period. And I really enjoyed that. And I loved sort of the impersonality of it and the exploration of something that I didn't know. And so I started out on something like that, about a writer in 1901 traveling with his mother around Europe. And my own mother died after I got about 20 pages into that book. And I just stopped writing altogether for a long time. And when I went back to writing fiction, I couldn't go back to that book. I couldn't even open the notebook. And so I, for whatever reason, this book poured out of me. And I think that it's something that I'd been a kind of feeling that I'd wanted to write for a long time, but didn't think that I really could get it right. And I definitely tapped into a lot of my own experiences or really my own emotions as being a young woman trying to write and cobbling together a lot of odd jobs to do so. And just the feeling that things weren't going well for many, many years and that I was never actually going to become a writer. So I really try to capture those emotions of fear and the panic and the confusion and the kind of moments of hope of that time for me.
I always like novels about writers, yet I've heard people in publishing, probably agents primarily, say never write about a writer. But I take it you haven't heard this.
Well, you know, I think I heard it afterwards. Everybody started saying it afterwards. I didn't know what he told me ahead of time. I love reading. I mean, that's the funny thing. This whole thing with my editor and my agent has been, you know, but I love reading books about writers. And I love the title, Writers and Lovers. And everyone's like, whoa, you have to stay away from that. I think I've made them come around eventually, but I don't think it was maybe their first desire when I first told them about it.
Was there another title?
No, there never was. I tried very hard to find something else because really nobody liked it at first. But I couldn't. I made an earnest effort to pour through that book and think hard about what else it could be called. But I couldn't come up with anything, and nor could anyone else. So that's what we ended up with.
And this book, as well as Euphoria, has a love triangle. So I was very much reminded of that book. And I was curious, why a love triangle?
You know, I find them to be very common. I mean, I feel like in my 20s and 30s, before I got married, there wasn't always one guy, you know, there was a lot. Everybody always had a few things going on, you know, long distance and in town and that kind of thing. I feel like, I don't know. It seemed kind of normal to me, but also it's just so much more interesting, you know, when there's just another angle of tension coming in. I like writing that.
Well, how much did you have going in? I mean, there's Casey's mother's death and her job as a server and dealing with the restaurant and all that. But how much did you have? I mean, you know, you talked about why the book you were working on wasn't going to work. But going into this, what did you need to have?
I just started taking notes on my computer, just random notes about a young woman. And it's funny, I get a lot of ideas, but there are only a few that are powerful enough to attract other ideas. And for whatever reason, I just kept going back to that file. And I kept on building and, you know, coming up with different characters. There are many more characters that never made it into the final draft. I had like 60 pages of this other guy. I mean, initially there were other men, but my agent and my editor felt like, you know, this was enough. And I guess I just really started, you know, drawing on those emotions that I had and then building this imaginary world from there. And it just kept growing, and I kept getting ideas. And then eventually I wrote that first paragraph, which is still the first paragraph. And then I really felt it. I felt like, okay, I see this novel already.
Do you have the book right there? Can you read a bit from it?
Yeah, sure.
Maybe the first few pages?
Sure.
Okay.
I have a pact with myself not to think about money in the morning. I'm like a teenager trying not to think about sex, but I'm also trying not to think about sex or Luke or death, which means not thinking about my mother who died on vacation last winter. There are so many things I can't think about in order to write in the morning. Adam, my landlord, watches me walk his dog. He leans against his Benz in a suit and sparkling shoes as I come back up the driveway. He's needy in the morning. Everyone is, I suppose. He enjoys his contrast to me in my sweats and untamed hair. When the dog and I are closer, he says, "You're up early." I'm always up early. So are you. Meeting with the judge at the courthouse at 7 sharp. Admire me, admire me, admire judge and courthouse and 7 sharp. Somebody's got to do it. I don't like myself around Adam. I don't think he wants me to. I let the dog yank me a few steps past him toward a squirrel, squeezing through some slats at the side of his big house. So, he says, unwilling to let me get too far away. How's the novel? He says it like I made the word up myself. He's still leaning against his car and turning only his head in my direction as if he likes his pose too much to undo it. It's all right. The bees in my chest stir. A few creep down the inside of my arm. One conversation can destroy my whole morning. I've got to get back to it. Short day, working a double. I pull the dog up out of his back porch, unhook the leash, nudge him through the door, and drop quickly back down the steps. How many pages you got now? A couple hundred, maybe. I don't stop moving. I'm halfway to my room at the side of his garage. You know, he says, pulling himself off his car, waiting for my full attention. I just find it extraordinary that you think you have something to say. I sit at my desk and stare at the sentences I wrote before walking the dog. I don't remember them. I don't remember putting them down. I'm so tired. I look at the green digits on the clock radio, less than 3 hours before I have to dress for my lunch shift. Adam went to college with my older brother, Caleb. In fact, I think Caleb was a little in love with him back then. And for this, he gives me a break in the rent. He shaves off a bit more for walking his dog in the morning. The room used to be a potting shed and still has a loam and rotting leaves smell. There's just enough space for a twin mattress, desk and chair, and hot plate, and toaster oven in the bathroom. I set the kettle back on the burner for another cup of black tea. I don't write because I think I have something to say. I write because if I don't, everything feels even worse.
Thank you so much. That was Lily King reading from Writers and Lovers, published by Grove Atlantic. And so I am curious about Adam. Where did he come from?
Oh, I think, you know, I definitely, there was a man once who said something like that to me. But there have been a lot of men who have said more or less something like that to me. So I think he kind of embodies a lot of the doubt that a young woman in the 90s, and I'm sure today, gets confronted with by a lot of people who, you know, for whom the creative life is a mystery, or it's scary, or it's something they wanted and they gave up, and they resent people who do it, or I don't, you know, for many reasons.
Do you write composites? Do you find your characters tend to be composites of people you've known, or people who represent experiences you've had, like that?
Sometimes I don't know it at the time. Mm-hmm. At the time, I feel like they're completely springing from my imagination. But later on, I'm like, oh, you know, that person's kind of like blah, 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 you know, and I start to match them up a little bit more. I mean, not always. Sometimes they've just, I don't know who they are. I don't know where they came from. But, you know, you can get little pieces here and there of people.
What about Oscar and Silas? Same thing.
Yeah. I mean, I think if I say too much, I'll blow it. And people haven't read the book. So, you know, there's little bits and pieces here and there.
Yeah.
But also huge, huge swaths of imagination. I mean, it's a funny thing to talk about, because the situation, the dialogue, what happens, it's all fiction, you know? Mm-hmm. You can't match it up with my life. I think you can only really match up the emotions and the way people made me feel and go from there. So it doesn't align in any way.
Yeah, I was going to ask if Casey's budding writing life mirrored your own.
In some ways, definitely. I mean, I so much felt her panic. I, you know, it was it was a very difficult time. I mean, I think I was 35 or 34 before I sold my first novel. So I had a lot of years of questioning, and I feel like it kind of caused the rest of my life to shrink or shut down. You know, I was only paying attention to my writing. And so all those other things that can flower at that age didn't flower. And in a way, I feel like Casey is experiencing the effects of of those choices as well.
And also, you know, back to Casey's mother's death, and your own experience of having your mother pass, was writing about her mother's death a way to deal with your own feelings? I mean, did it serve as sort of a purging, a way to purge, or really to examine? I don't know.
Yes, it absolutely did. I think I knew that I needed a place for all of these feelings. I really feel like I probably created this book so I could write about that. Because it shows up in the first paragraph, you know, It obviously was really important to me. And it took me many months to get to a place where I could actually write about it. But some of those scenes where I really get to a kernel of what I was going through were truly cathartic to write. I mean, to be able to create art out of extreme pain is really, really a gift. So I feel just happy that I was able to get that out.
Yeah. And what about the point of view, the first person present tense? I don't think I even noticed that at first. And then I think sometimes you're so aware of the writer writing in first person present tense. Mm-hmm. And I did not notice. And then I go, oh, wait a minute. She's doing this. Right. Good. I mean, I love novels in first person present tense. But how did you come to that?
You know, I believe that I started it in the past. I do think I used the past tense for the first couple of pages, but I very quickly switched. And I think I might have switched just unconsciously. And then suddenly I was writing it in the first person. And then I went back and I corrected the rest of it. I was on the fence. I remember, you know, thinking, should I really do this? Because I'd done it before. And I have this memory of being at one of these really little book fairs in Portland, Maine, you know, selling my book with a bunch of other writers in this basement auditorium kind of thing. And a woman coming up to my table, picking it up, opening the first page and throwing it down and saying to me directly, I hate novels in the first person.
Great.
That's always stuck in my head. I'm like, okay. So I definitely had her on my mind when I chose the present tense again. It just felt right. It felt, I didn't want her to be looking back. I didn't want it to feel like that. I just really wanted this as and there's just a very immediate experience for the reader.
And also it kind of ups the tension, right? Because things she's going through or dealing with the doctor, you know, various things, we don't know, you know, just like she doesn't know, we don't know what's going to happen.
Right, exactly.
And the voice too, the voice was really kind of different from Euphoria. And how do you get to voice?
For me, it either comes or it doesn't. Mm-hmm. If it doesn't come, forget it. It's dead in the water. With Euphoria, the voice is mostly Andrew Bankson, and so very, very loosely based on Gregory Bateson, whose biography I had read, and I just connected with him. I thought it was going to be in Nell Stone's voice, the anthropologist, you know, that he meets there, but I tried that and it just, I mean, I had to have diary entries from her, but he was the one who I really connected with and really felt like I could channel something about him into the book. And I don't know really where that came from, but I loved it. I just loved being in his voice. And then, I don't know, Casey just, you know, she started mouthing off, you know, just the way she is. You know, she's very different from me. She's much more outspoken. She's sort of more hair trigger and maybe more tightly wound than I am. She came out of the gate kind of like that right from the start.
I have to ask you about the use of single quotation marks.
Oh,
I felt like I was reading a British novel. I'm like, no, she's from Maine.
Yes. I know. I love British novels. I really, so many of my favorite writers are Brits, and I don't know why. I just love the single quotation, probably because just, you know, harkens back to all the books that I've loved so much. And of course, but a lot of them use dashes, so it doesn't always work. I wrote it like this, and then they changed it all to, when the copy edits happened, they changed it all to double quotations. And I wrote and I said, can we go back? And they're like, sure. And I thought I was going to have to fight for it, because I had actually written The Pleasing Hour like this, and they wouldn't let me do it. But now I've gotten a little bit more power. So, yeah. I don't know. It seems excessive for me. But I know Americans aren't used to it as much.
No, it's interesting, you know, but I was so curious. I'm like, okay, something's going on here with this.
No. It's not meant to imply anything except that the author really loves British novels.
Well, speaking of novels, and we're getting close to the end of our time, a couple of books maybe that you've loved and have influenced you and perhaps you return to. Anything that comes up?
Yes, I mean, tons, but most recently, maybe My Name is Lucy Barton by Elizabeth Strout. I loved that book so very much. I love Department of Speculation by Jenny Offal. Mm-hmm. I just bought her Weather yesterday, and I'm so excited to read it. I love Tessa Hadley, really all of her books, but I love Sunstroke, which is a collection of short stories, and I loved her most recent, Late in the Day. She's a Brit. I love Rachel Cusk, particularly The Lucky Ones, which is a collection of short stories from a while ago. I know I'm missing. I love everything Colm Tóibín writes. Marilynne Robinson. And then, I could go way back.
Sure.
You know, lots of other things.
And you mentioned Elizabeth Strout and another Maine writer. It seems like there's quite a few writers that live in Maine. It's like this place, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I wish you could see out my window. And you'd understand. It's, you know, just a bunch of rooftops covered in snow, and it's all the leaves off the trees, and it's the perfect place to write.
Sounds great to me.
Cozy, and, you know.
So a couple more things, or maybe one more thing, because endings are always, so interesting to me. The ending of a book is sort of what sends you to the next book, perhaps, and Euphoria had one of the best endings ever, and I tell everybody, if for no other reason, read the book for the ending, because you know, it's so good, and the ending of this one works so well too.
Oh,
what are endings like for you, and how do you know when you have it? What are you looking for? What are you trying to?
I don't know. I try so hard not to think about them. I mean, I really do, because I know I have to have one, and I never know what it is. And in fact, with Euphoria, when I handed that book in to my writers group and to my agent, that book ended the chapter before. I didn't have the last chapter. And then I was really driving on the highway to meet a friend for lunch, and I was late, and I turned off the highway, and I just saw the scene in the museum. It was just right there. It was literally, I felt like it was in that button was embedded in my windshield. Like I saw it all. And so then I had to pull out a notebook as I'm turning off the highway and I'm late to meet my friend, and I can't pull over because I'm so late. And I just start scribbling, you know. I jump in time to the late 70s, I think it was, or early 80s, and the museum scene, and, you know, everything that I see right there. And so that was a complete surprise. Then I had to run to all of my writers, people in my writers group, to their houses and deliver the new chapter, send into my agent. And so that was kind of my most dramatic ending writing situation. But and with this one, you know, I kind of just kept going until I felt like it was there, you know, and I knew when I saw it coming up somehow. with the geese and everything. I saw that coming, but not from very far away, probably only a few chapters behind it did I come up with the idea.
Yeah,
and once you hit the ending, you're like, okay, that's it. You just kind of step aside.
And the geese are there from the start, pretty much. I mean, mm-hmm. the geese are very much a part of the book. So it just, it was a great ending. Any last words or words of advice or wisdom for the writers who are listening?
Oh, don't give up. Don't give up hope, really. You just have to keep writing. There's no trick to it. You just have to sit down and keep writing.
Lily, thank you so much for taking the time.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Take care.